You are listening to the On Humans podcast. This is your host, Ilari Mäkelä. We like to box things into neat categories. We like to box ourselves into a self, a me, an independent soul perhaps caged away from the rest of the world by the bags of our skin. When something goes wrong in our mental health, we like to box the issues into neat buckets of mental health disorders and search for an answer within this individuated cage within our body, our mind, our neurochemistry. On the other hand, we like to think of this self as a solid, unified, and permanent me, caged not only from the outside, but also from fundamental change. What if this is all a mistake? What if thinking about ourselves as atomic individuals has misled us in our thinking about mental health? And what if thinking about our inner life as a family of different selves could help us change, grow, and face our fears better? We explore these and other questions in today's episode with Gregory Burns. Burns is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist at Emory University, whose most recent book is titled Self-Delusion. Self-Delusion is actually out on the same day as this podcast is released, 18th of October. In this discussion, we explore various ways in which the self is, if not a delusion, then at least much more fluid than we typically give it right. We touch upon questions such as, do we have a too atomic idea about the self, denying the role of other people or society, even fictional characters and inanimate objects in making us who we are? Has this led us astray in our approach to mental health? This you can think about as a zooming out argument, that the self is perhaps greater than just us, just our head, just our body. And then there is also a kind of zooming in argument, that perhaps there are many selves, many eyes, many yous, and perhaps this can inspire new approaches, new ways of looking at mental health and therapy. We also discuss the question, where, if anywhere, is the self located, and why it feels so much better to locate it into the heart than to the brain. This was a wide-ranging discussion with very few certainties, but many explorations. As always, there is a full list of technical terms and names mentioned in that you can find in the show notes. There you will also find a small correction about what I say when I mention internal family dynamics therapy. I'm actually talking about internal family systems therapy, IFST, a technique that I highly recommend everyone to check out. Even if you're not in for official therapy, there are many self-help things you can find there. I hope that you enjoy the episode. I bring to you Gregory Burns. Professor Gregory Burns, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
And congrats on finishing a new book, Self-Delusion. This is not your first one, but I guess it's always a journey.
Yeah, this is actually my fifth book. And coincidentally, my author copy has actually just arrived yesterday. So it's always a bit exciting. And this book, I think, was particularly drawn out because it was something I began before COVID and then finished during COVID and for a variety of reasons changed forms during that period of time. So it was much more drawn out than I would have liked it to have been. So it's kind of bittersweet that it's finally done. But yeah, the day has finally arrived.
And what was the spark? What was the impetus in the beginning?
Well, when I think I signed the contract in the fall of 2019, so literally right before COVID hit, the original plan was to write a book largely about narrative and how narratives are embedded in our brains, really with the emphasis on narrative, not with the emphasis that it ended up being, which is more on self-identity and how we construct who we think we are. And that's kind of how it morphed into something else, which we can get into.
Yeah, I was curious because I don't know if I'm paraphrasing too liberally, if I'm saying that you're broadly in the camp associated with Buddhism or David Hume, that the idea that there is a permanent self underneath all of these psychological processes is a certain kind of an illusion, delusion.
Yeah, I would say so. The title certainly, you know, telegraphs where I'm coming from. To be a little more conservative about it, you know, one might say it's an illusion, not a delusion. You know, titling of books is a bit of marketing and something authors don't have full control over. But in the extreme, I guess we could say that the notion of self is itself a delusion.
The reason I'm curious was that I think there's people who are interested in this from a very philosophical point of view. And you've written earlier books that have to do with philosophical questions.
Right.
But is it a philosophical issue for you? Or was it something, you're also come from psychiatry background. Was it to understand some mental well-being issue? You know, why is this a story that you wanted to tell? This story about the self being illusionary, delusionary, or however we want to call it.
I don't know if it's a philosophical issue because, of course, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not trained in philosophy. And to say that I have a particular philosophy would probably be too generous because, honestly, if I had a solid philosophy, that itself would be a contradiction of the very things that I'm arguing for.
Yeah,
because that could change just as easily as anything else.
I see.
You know, no, I did not set out to kind of hone a particular edge on a philosophical slant on self-identity. Like I said, it originally began as a kind of a meditation on storytelling. So I've always been fascinated by storytelling and stories. I mean, who's not fascinated by stories, really?
Yes.
They're so central to the human experience because, of course, we're the only animal that tells stories. So this notion of what is a story? First, that is what fascinated me. And then secondly, going back to some of the neuroscience studies that we did a decade ago, can we find evidence for stories or more generally narratives embedded in the brain? Can we actually see them? And if we can we find evidence that the stories, the content themselves actually change the brain in the sense that, you know, stories change or shape who we are? Because it very much feels that way, especially when we're younger. Stories have particularly powerful effect. And if we have that subjective feeling that, you know, if you read a story, a novel, whatever, and you feel that it has somehow changed you, well, then by definition, I guess it has changed you. And really the question I've been pursuing is, okay, how does it change you? Can we measure it? Can we see it in the brain? And once identified, what does that tell us about taking control of the process, either by consuming different stories or telling different stories and that interplay between the stories and who we are.
So what would be a quick take currently on your neuroscientist point of view? Do stories change our brain and how?
The simple answer, and you know, a lot of neuroscientists will say, well, that's a stupid question because obviously it changes the brain. Everything changes the brain. And I think that's a little too glib to brush it off. Like, yes, everything does change the brain. That's not really the question. The question is, how does it change the brain? And then if we can identify those changes and where they happen and the nature of them, what does that tell us? How does that inform us about what stories are and how they make us who we are? So the simple answer is yes. Obviously, stories change the brain, as does everything that we encounter. The deeper answer is, okay, well, how and where does it happen? And there have not been a great number of studies on this. One of the ones that we did and really was the impetus for the book many, many years ago was we actually did a very logistically complicated study where we recruited 20 undergraduates over a summer. And the plan was to scan their brains every day. So we did something called resting state functional MRI, which is a way of measuring connectivity between the different parts of the brain. And then in the middle of this, we did this every day for 3 weeks. And in the middle of it, the idea was to give them a novel to read. And we actually took a novel and a physical paperback and tore it up into sections over 9 days. And we gave them a section every night to read. And then they would come in the next morning and we would scan their brains. And we did this every single day for 3 weeks. as I said, logistically horrible to...
Yeah, how many came up today?
Well, we incentivized participation. We basically said, we will pay you $400 to do this study. But for every day that you miss, you're going to lose something like $50.
So it's an expensive decision to stay in bed.
Yeah, exactly. And in the end, so I think we started with, I think we recruited two extra. So I think we started with 22 and then I think 19 did every session. So that was quite good. And what we found was not what I was expecting. And so the areas that we found the most significant changes in connectivity during the reading of the novel actually corresponded to sensory motor regions.
What would you have expected?
I kind of expected regions associated with semantic knowledge, so more frontal and temporal regions. So you would think kind of going in areas more associated with memory and storing facts and things like that would show the changes. Perhaps language areas because you're exercising language. And indeed, we did see areas in language changing. But really, the most interesting effects were in areas around the sensory and motor regions of the cortex. And this was quite surprising because obviously the people were not doing anything differently in terms of their physical activity. And so the tempting conclusion, speculative, yes, but the implication was that the act of reading the novel literally put the reader in the protagonist's shoes as if they were simulating being that person.
Yes.
That was the primary interpretation. It's because we didn't really have any other good explanation for why changes should be happening there. You know, there are theories about this type of effect. It's called embodied cognition.
Yeah. And yeah. I was just thinking of metaphors we live by, the book by, was it Mark Johnson and Lakoff, I think, where they wrote about how so much of our language is actually about metaphors of seeing and doing, and so how a lot of even more abstract thinking has to do with kind of sensory and motor areas. So that was one of the first things I thought about when I was reading that study. Was that a link that came to your mind also?
Yeah, certainly one of them. You know, even if you just kind of go back to the basics of writing and storytelling. So, you know, really the hallmark of good writing is that it immerses the reader into the world the writer has created. The best writing just drops you right in and you feel like you're that character. And that was my interpretation of what we found. And as I said, this study kind of had stayed in my mind for a good 10 years. And I had always intended to write, you know, a popular book about that and what it meant.
And so just to be clear, do I remember correctly that what was most remarkable wasn't that reading engages these sensory motor areas, but that there are semi-permanent post-reading changes in these areas?
That's right. So because the way we set it up, there was essentially what we call a wash-in and a wash-out period, 5 days before and 5 days after the nights that they were reading. So we were specifically looking for changes associated with the novel itself. So things that just happened during the days that they were reading, and then other changes that persisted afterwards. And so the sensory motor changes were in that latter category. And so that's why we don't think it was strictly due to just engaging whatever reading processes were happening. We think something changed at least on a short-term basis for a few days.
Well, okay, then let's leave the narratives for a while and go to the proper delusion part, self-delusion part of it. I guess one of the ways to ground this would be to take some of the most extreme examples that you discuss. I think probably the most mind-boggling one would be dissociative identity disorder, DID. What do we know about it? I mean, it's such a mind-bending thing to just read about. What is the DID? What do we know about it?
Well, so the popular term, of course, is multiple personality disorder. That was the term we used when I was training in psychiatry. It later was changed to dissociative identity disorder. This is a very peculiar disorder, which is relatively modern, I think, in its description. You know, many of the mental illnesses, like depression, were described by the Greeks. DID or MPD is not one of them. The whole notion of it actually started in the late 1800s. That's when the first cases of multiple personality began to be described. There are a number of famous cases that are in the literature. The first one who was described to have it went by the name of Miss Beauchamp. But there were many others. Freud, of course, got his fingers involved in the description of it. Then later, these cases began to appear in the popular press, or people write novels about them.
For those who are not familiar, what would be like a really quick summary of the DID? What happens in it? What are the symptoms?
Well, okay, so let me start with kind of the older way, the multiple personality description. And the idea in MPD was that there are folks who literally harbor distinct personalities and they can come and go. Later on, and this kind of gets into the dissociative identity facet of it, a lot of researchers changed the name because it seemed to exist on a continuum with other psychological phenomena, which they called dissociation. And dissociation is fairly common. Most people experience it at some point or another during their life. And these are instances in which, for example, you might have the experience of floating outside your body, out-of-body experiences. Oftentimes, they're associated with traumatic events. And you can easily kind of reconstruct one in your mind. If you don't think you've ever had one, well, I would say, yeah, you probably do. Because if you go back and kind of cull your memory banks for something that happened to you as a child, oftentimes the memory will be from a third-person perspective, right?
Yes, yes. And I've heard that especially with negative memories, that it's
exactly
a way to distance oneself from the trauma, or the accident, or the whatever the trauma may be.
Yeah. So for example, one of my earliest memories is probably when I was about 3 or 4. I was somehow stuck at the bottom of a very large hill. I must have slipped down and I was in a forest and I couldn't get back up again. My memory of it is from a third person perspective. I mean, it's like I'm hovering and I can see myself, you know, stuck at the bottom of this hill. I do not have a memory from a first person perspective anymore. I don't really have one of looking up the hill. I can imagine it, but when I call up that memory, that's not the one that comes to mind initially. And you know, there are other instances, say, you know, like being in a car accident that very kind of quickly turns into a third person perspective, not first person. And so those are kind of mild versions of dissociation. They have to be constructed, right? Because there's no way that you can have a third person view of yourself.
You wrote quite well in the book there. I'm quoting from memory, but there is no way that you have a third person memory. Because there was no third person who would be remembering it, at least not you.
Right. But we could, you know, we can dig a little deeper to try to understand how those things occur. And again, you know, I use a personal example here. You know, there was one time, this was more in my teens, I was probably about 16 or so at the time, and I used to ride my bicycle everywhere. And then there was one day I was riding my bike along the road that was paralleling a highway, and there was a large semi truck, must have lost control. Maybe a wheel tire went flat, or I don't know the reason, but the truck started to veer off the road and veer out of the lane and head directly towards me on the bike. And at the very last minute, the driver, I think he probably saw me, and he kind of turned sharply and the truck crashed into a hillside, and there's like great plume of dust and dirt in the air. And then when it cleared, you know, the truck was jackknifed and the driver and a passenger had been ejected onto the hill. And I was the only one there. And I ran over to help them. Not that I could do much. And then people started arriving and this guy came up to me and he said, "Kid, I saw you. I saw the whole thing happen. And I thought you were going to be a goner." And then from that point on, my memory took his perspective instead of my own. Well, I actually have both in my head, but oftentimes now when I remember it, it's from his perspective you know, seeing myself riding a bike, a truck barreling towards me. And what's remarkable about that is the remembering of the event was happening as the event was still unfolding, because the guy came up to me and said, yeah, you know, I saw everything from up on the hill. And so immediately I started imagining that while I'm still, you know, jacked up on adrenaline, you know, barely minutes after the event itself, the retelling of it begins and completely muddies what actually happened.
Yeah.
And now, yeah, 40 years later, I have no accurate recollection. I just have mashed up bits and pieces of what I remembered combined with what, you know, other people told me at the time. And this, honestly, this is not unusual. This is how many memories are for everyone.
Yeah, let's return to DID soon, but dwelling on this point for a little further, a couple of things. I remember reading some article once about how third person memories about positive events are common in depression, because you're distancing yourself from it, which is normal for negative memories. When people are doing it also for the positive memories, would be perhaps even causally associated with, perhaps just correlationally, with depression and some other mental health disorder. Have you ever heard about that? Do you have any take on that?
Interesting. No, I had not heard that.
I can try to find it and send it to you after. And if I do, I'll put it in the show notes also for listeners. But yeah, I think this is also one of the things that is kind of like memory psychology lecture, you know, 101 memory course. There will be something about reconstructive memories, and the extreme examples are not third person perspective. The extreme examples are complete false memories. Like, I remember during my undergrad, we learned about how it used to be common for police interrogations. Well, they're not common, but it was acceptable to give fake information to a person who's being interrogated, as a way to kind of make the culprit say, oh yeah, okay, it was me, because you already know it. And there was one case of someone whose parents were murdered, and the police told the person that before they died in the hospital, they were able to tell that it was you who did it. And this poor chap had a false memory about it, confessed, and was in jail for a while before DNA evidence came to save him.
Yes, yes.
So that's really dramatic. But how common do you think this is? Because there is a difference between seeing a pretty accurate representation from a third person perspective and having this kind of a completely life-altering false memory, which is in no way related to the fact, which is induced by a certain kind of interrogation technique.
I think it's a continuum, as are many of these phenomena. You know, one of the things that I also talk about in the book was studies on social conformity that were done in the 50s and 60s. And
these are the classic Ashe's line experiments, for those who remember it from psychology textbooks.
Yes, exactly. And so Ashe designed those experiments to be perceptually unambiguous. That was the whole point. And then you put a person in a room full of Confederates who have been told to answer incorrectly, and some percentage of people will go along with the group. Now, Ashe did not believe that the group was changing the individual's perception. He thought that people would go along with the group just for the social benefit of doing so, and you know, or they were afraid to stand out. When I went back and looked at those studies, you know, I wasn't so sure about that, because he debriefed the people, and there was always one or two people who kind of said, well, you know, I just, you know, the other people said it was this, and you know, then I kind of questioned my own judgment, so maybe I wasn't right.
That is fascinating, by the way, because I have a student with whom we discussed about this, and I said to him, not having read these papers, I said, you know, we don't know why they conform, maybe because of social pressure, maybe because they saw differently. And he came back to me saying that, no, I actually learned from the textbook that it was just normative, so-called normative conformity. It was just because social pressure, they obviously knew it. And I was like, well, okay, that's what the textbook says, but I don't know why they say that. So I'm glad that somebody went deeper and actually digged in.
Yeah. And so, you know, that actually was the motivation for another set of fMRI studies that I did, you know, over a decade ago, where we tried to reconstruct a version of these Ashe experiments in the scanner to see if we could tell, you know, where other people's influence was occurring. And this should be pretty straightforward, because when other people are telling you they're seeing one thing and you're seeing something different, is this something that affects processing in perceptual regions, or is it something that affects processing, say, in frontal regions where you might expect something like inhibitory control to be active. Like you know what the answer is, but you choose to override it.
So one hypothesis is that when people see a line that is clearly shorter than another one, but everybody says it's longer, they want to say the right answer, but then they have these frontal regions kind of putting the brakes on so as not to be a social pariah. The other hypothesis is that something to do with the perceptual areas, or what would you say? What's the alternative hypothesis?
Exactly. And so this is what we found when we did the study. It was more complicated than the line experiments. We actually used a task called mental rotation, where you have two objects on the screen. These are kind of Tetris-like objects, and you have to decide if they're the same or not by mentally rotating one. And in fact, we did find evidence in perceptual regions that when people give the wrong answer, it causes increased processing in the perceptual regions associated with that task. Which, it's not a smoking gun that, yes, their perception changed, but what it suggests is when people say, essentially, I see things differently, that causes an individual to imagine, if you will, from that person's perspective, what they're seeing. And of course, when you imagine something, it's generally going to repurpose your perceptual circuits for the purpose of imagination. I call it running perception in reverse. And so that can compete with what your eyes are transmitting and essentially result in a competition of percepts, if you will. And that's how we interpreted that.
One real percept and one imaginative.
Exactly.
Almost empathetic percept in this.
Yeah. You know, and we do that all the time. You know, if someone says, I see it that way, you know, maybe you close your eyes and try to imagine what they're seeing. In my work over the last 10 or 20 years, you know, these themes keep reoccurring, which at the time that I was doing the studies, I was not thinking in terms of self-identity. But, you know, you see these results in different forms, very different types of experiments. Then in the end, I began to wonder, it's like, well, what thought is truly my own anyway? You know, whether it's the guy on the hill telling me he saw the accident happen, you know, and now I have a memory which is from his perspective, or whether it's, you know, these simple Ash type things where, you know, you have other people's opinions, they get in your head. And by definition, if it's in your head, it is part of you.
Fascinating. Thank you. That's a really nice crystallization of the idea. Let's return to DID for a moment. I've actually discussed it in a previous conversation I had with a philosopher called Bernardo Kastrup. He uses it in very different ways, but I learned from him some very wild examples of what can happen in DID. One of them was that these kind of different personalities are called different alters.
That's the modern terminology that some people use, yeah.
Okay. And so there was one patient who had dreams where these alters would be in the same dream and different alters would see the dream from the different alters' perspective. And this is quite, it's, I can see the idea that this is in a sense just an extreme example of this continuum where we sometimes can dissociate away from our own point of view in as mundane a thing as remembering something from the third person point of view. But there also seems to be something really radical going on in these cases. And I don't know, how much do you know about the neuroscience literature around explaining DID? Do we know, like, I know that there are some ways that, at least in some studies, people have been kind of able to know which alter is in charge, so to speak, based on neuroimaging. So there's something going on that is detectable from the brain. But do we know what causes this? And so I guess two questions. One is, do we know what causes this? And second, is it not that this is so dramatically different from our everyday perspective that even if it's on a continuum, it should still be, there's still some kind of rupture, you know, in there. There's something changes qualitatively when you get right that far.
There have been a few imaging studies of this, but not many. I mean, as you might imagine, one, it's hard to find people, you know, that legitimately, you know, have this disorder. And then what exactly, then you're kind of faced with the question. It's like, well, what exactly are you going to image and what would you expect to see? Yeah. As I recall, there's maybe one or two studies where, you know, maybe you look at connectivity or correlations to see if the brain somehow assumes a different configuration at kind of baseline. But it's very, you know, these measurements, of course, are noisy and they're not conclusive in my mind on what is happening. You know, so I was trained as a psychiatrist, and at least in the United States, where the DSM kind of rules the diagnosis of mental disorders, it's, you know, it's essentially a checklist type approach to diagnosis. By design, mental illness is a threshold. You either have enough of these symptoms where you cross the threshold and then you're diagnosed with a disorder, or you're below threshold. I think that's quite problematic, really, because over the years I've come to assume a continuum approach, you know, to psychology and mental illness, that these disorders, even the most extreme like schizophrenia, are also on a continuum, that they represent one end of human experience, not categorically different, just more extreme.
I've heard some people who make the same argument say that historically, one of the reasons why we do conceptualize mental disorders in this very categorical way is there was a little bit of like medicine envy among psychiatrists, or maybe to put it more charitably, a desire to be taken more seriously, for mental health to be taken as seriously as we take folks who study, you know, whether you have polio or not, or whether you have COVID or not. There's a yes and no answer. And so creating a rubric which would kind of mirror that medicinal categorical taxonomy of disease was in a certain way perhaps even necessary to get mental health to be recognized as an integral part of medicine. I don't know, do you think that has some truth historically?
I do. I think there is medicine envy. I trained during the golden era of biological psychiatry. That's what drew me to it. So yes, I was seduced by the medicalization of psychiatry. And in the end, it was a false idol. It does not, in my experience, the biological treatments that we have for psychiatric illness are not nearly as effective as drug companies would have you believe. I remember when I was in training as a resident, and I would be in the emergency room, and I would see people come in for psychiatric reasons. And it always puzzled me. It's like, well, why is this person here? You know, is it because they have hallucinations? Is it because they're, you know, screaming that the CIA has implanted them with something in their brains? It's like, no, that's not why they're there at that moment, because there are lots of people walking around with those beliefs. There's something else. There's something, kind of a failure of their social support system that has broken down, that caused them to be picked up by the police and brought to a psychiatric ER. So, yeah.
I guess the difficulty there is that even today, say with, I think, a very easy way to conceptualize this question would be with depression. When somebody has major depressive disorder, do we say that it's just, well, we can all understand what it's like to be depressed. Well, they're really far on the continuum. And in a sense, I guess what you're saying is that is more accurate. But then again, it can also become a problem because of people around not taking the issue seriously enough. I know what it's like to be depressed. They're just a little bit depressed. And no, this requires a certain level of care that just being down for one day does not. And maybe our minds are just such that having this kind of neat buckets where you can put something in makes it easier to take seriously. I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts are. It does.
I mean, yeah. Who wouldn't like to take a pill and feel better, right? Humans have been doing that for millennia. It's human nature to alter our consciousness in ways that we think make us feel better. So yeah, it's very seductive to biologicalize mental health when you can only go so far with that. I think people realize that now. It's like, okay, you know, how many antidepressants does a person have to take and they don't get fully better? There's something else missing.
What is missing?
Well, I'm not a Freudian. I do not adhere to that framework of the psyche. But what is clear is that ultimately these breakdowns have to do with social connectedness. It's the isolation that these disorders cause that result kind of in the spiral down. And society has become such that we're not very good at addressing that anymore.
That's a hell of an answer.
I think in times past when society was much smaller and we lived in smaller groups that we were a bit better at it. Because when humans lived in smaller communities, there was, you know, you need to take care of your community in order for the community and the individuals within it to survive. And so you can't just hide the person who has odd beliefs. You know, it's like, okay, well, you look out for each other a little bit. And my viewpoint on this has changed quite a bit in the last 2 years since I moved out of the city. And now I live in the country and I live in a very different community than I did 2 years ago. And I see the difference. Not necessarily better, but different.
Better in some regards, I'm sure. I think that would be one angle to explaining the almost like a weird paradox, I feel like. If somebody asks, is the world going to a better or a worse direction when it comes to mental health? Well, it's obvious that it's going to better in the way that there's much more treatments available. We take it much more seriously, less stigmatization. On the other hand, there seems to be that numbers are not looking great when you just look at how much mood disorders, anxiety disorders there are, especially for the young. And I guess that would be one way to explain it, is that the sociologists and social scientists have been documenting this really dramatic, I don't want to sound too dramatic, but almost like a collapse of community, or at least decrease in community. I mean, the classic work on this would be Bowling Alone, but there's plenty of work around how, you know, wherever is it, since the Second World War, since 60s, since 70s, 80s, wherever you pick the beginning, there's been this decline in communities.
Yeah.
And I guess if that is one of the root causes of mental health problems, maybe then that would explain this certain paradox.
Yeah.
Or at least part of it. I'm not saying it's the only explanation.
Right.
Good. Okay. Well, let's move on. One of the fascinating things I learned from the book was your theory of why so many people, so many cultures have located the soul in the heart. Because when we're talking about the self-delusion, obviously one of the questions that comes is this idea that, well, where is the self in the brain, in the body, you know? And part of this is kind of trying to find the soul in the brain. But a lot of people intuitively, it's not in the brain, it's in the heart. And am I paraphrasing you correctly that the brain represents the world and the body, but it cannot represent the body and the world and itself? And so there's no representation of the brain in the brain, and therefore the brain doesn't consider the brain as a location, in a sense. And on the other hand, when we look at where do various emotions feel like, a lot of them feel in the area of the heart, in the chest, whether it's grief or joy. Would that be an accurate way to put it?
Yes, I think that's right. And this notion that the self exists in the head is probably more modern, as we've discovered more about how the brain works. And that seems to be the organ that does all the computations that make us who we are. It's natural to assume that that's where the self is, if anywhere. But, you know, I tell the story of this class that I teach. So every year I teach a small class of undergraduates how to do brain imaging. And the class is essentially oriented around designing an experiment. So they get to decide what they want to study. They figure out how they're going to program some task, and then they're going to implement it on each other, put each other in the scanner, collect data, analyze it, and, you know, tell us what they found. So a big part of that is they go in the scanner to do each other's experiments. They get to see what their brain looks like. So when someone sees their brain for the first time, initially they're very excited. It's like, oh, wow, that's my brain.
Yes.
And then if they think about it for, you know, a few seconds, then it's like, then they're instantly deflated. It's like,
yes.
Well, that's My brain. Is that, that's it?
That's it.
And it's really peculiar because you have no relationship to your brain. Unless you scan it and then you have some kind of relationship to it because you can see it. But normally you don't have any relationship at all to it. You can't feel it. You can't see it. And even if you could poke it, it wouldn't feel anything.
Yeah. It's not a very warm relationship, at least.
No. And so everything that we feel about ourselves is mapped to some other part of our body, right? So our emotions get mapped to our heart and our stomach and our gut or our hands and our feet. You know, that's the brain's interpretation of these sensations that kind of get reprojected out onto other parts that actually do have sensations. And that's, you know, why in English we call emotions feelings. I don't know what words do you have in Finnish for?
Well, we don't actually have the distinction between emotion and feeling, which I think is very, very helpful when you get to these debates about animal emotions, for example.
Interesting.
So we can talk about that later. But yeah, we have a very similar word for it's feeling, tunne, which means to feel or to sense. And that's it. there's no construct such as emotion, which is plugged on top. And then for scientists and philosophers to debate whether feelings and emotions are same or different.
So you can't
really make sense of those debates in Finnish, which I find helpful. Anyway, so yeah, please go ahead.
So then that begs the question of like, okay, well, if you have a self, a singular self, where is it? Is it in the head? Is it in the heart? Does it even exist outside of your body? And so I think we can also make a case for that as well, that the self can expand and contract. So the best example of that is driving a car. When you're driving a car, the car feels as an extension of your body. You know, once you've been driven it long enough, you know, you treat it as an extension. And you can instantly know that this is true because when you're a passenger in the car, you do not get that sensation.
And is there something literal about that neurologically? I mean, I know that there are these studies about, for example, people who are blind.
Well, what it comes down to is what I talk about is the predictive brain. So a big function of the brain is to predict the future so that both for survival purposes, but also for simple motor acts. And so we know that when you're engaged in some motor act, the brain creates what's called a forward model. So like when you're reaching for a coffee mug, your brain is kind of creating a trajectory of how you have to move your hand to pick up a mug. And it's constantly making course corrections so that you get to your target. And you know that you do when you can feel it. Similarly, if you take your index finger and you touch your nose, you feel it kind of as one sensation. You kind of have this merged sensation in your fingertip and the tip of your nose. It's not like you have two sensations. And that's because your brain has created a forward model of what it's expecting to happen. It expects you to feel something on your fingertip and on the tip of your nose. And so it merges those. When you're not engaged in that kind of active process, there's no forward model. And so when something touches your nose, it feels from the outside. And you can kind of duplicate it by reaching your head over the top of your head and touching it from an odd angle, because then the forward model doesn't have a lot of experience. So all that tells us is that the self can expand and contract. It's not necessarily even limited to our own body.
One of the things that I found important and almost liberating about this kind of thought experiment while reading your book, of taking it as seriously as I can, this idea of there not being a unified self, it happened to coincide with me talking to a friend who has been kind of experimenting on a kind of self-therapy technique that is similar to the internal family dynamics therapy. Are you familiar with that technique?
No.
It's quite fascinating. The basic idea is that it has nothing to do with family. Here's the first thing. So the idea is to conceptualize various parts of yourself as a person and seeing them almost as a family. And so the idea would be like, you know, you're afraid of something, you can call this fear with a name, fear Fred, or whatever. And then you visualize or imagine meeting this fear and asking, what is it that you really want? How can we help you? You know, bringing that kind of compassionate attitude that we have towards our friends, towards these emotions. So not identifying with it, not being afraid, but having a discussion with this fear, taking it very seriously, but in this compassionate, friendly, kind way, instead of the much harsher way that we, I think, ironically often treat ourselves rather than our friends. But anyway, yeah, so I have a friend who's been experimenting on this kind of techniques, merging it with cognitive behavioral therapy and self-hypnosis. And we did some exercises with him, and it happened to coincide with me reading Self-Delusion. I saw a link in there, and it was quite fascinating. I just to notice how liberating it can be to take an emotion that seriously, but in that kind of friendly, arm's length way, and imagining this discussion with it.
It is very liberating. And, you know, I take that very literally and talk a little bit about this towards the end of my book, that if you accept the idea that there's not a singular self, however you want to define it, that there are multiple yous, there are different ways to look at it. There's the past you, the present, and the future you as kind of different versions of self. There's also the different yous that you adopt in different social circumstances. So there are very different, and it's a matter of degree. Some people feel a slave to the past, their past self in many ways. But, you know, as I like to tell people, I say, well, look at a picture of yourself from 20 years ago. Is that the same person you are today? Physically, you're very different. On the outside, you're different. Certainly, your brain has changed, especially if you go back to childhood. In my view, in no way, shape, or form are those the same people. So how much are you beholden to your past selves? And I think once you realize this, if you desire change, it can be very liberating to kind of free yourself from your past selves.
Gregory Burns, your book is Self-Delusion. It is out 18th of October. Thank you so much for letting me have a read before it and having this discussion.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to this conversation and following us till the very end. If you enjoyed it, please consider sharing the episode with someone else and, of course, just subscribing to the podcast. This way you will also hear about my second episode with Gregory Burns. In that discussion, we will focus on Burns' previous book, What Is It Like to Be a Dog? Burns is a dog lover and someone who, when his beloved dog passed away, wanted to see what fMRI scanning could reveal about the age-old question. How much do dogs actually care about humans? Are they there mainly for the food? Or can they feel love? Until next time, take care.